Edition of the Pearl Snap Tactical Podcast. I'm your host, Mark, and we are being recorded live from an undisclosed station south of the Mason-Dixon line. I'm joined here with my guest, Bill Buppert, who is a former Intel professional and all around spooky, cool dude. Bill, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's an honor to be on, and thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, man. So to the audience, I came across Stack. I started reading your articles, looking at your background, and I found a lot of intrigue that you talk about that I know you're into, especially if given the day and age that we're living in. But before we get into all of that, why don't you talk a little bit about your background and the things that you cover in your Substack and your other work?
Thanks. So I spent a quarter century in uniform. I was enlisted in the Navy. I'm a Mustang, and I got a commission in the U.S. Army. I have served in a variety of infantry, special operations, airborne, air assault organizations. Retired in 2003, took 4 years to get the lead out, became a civilian contractor, did a number of things to include being an irregular warfare senior advisor and teaching officers at professional military education, that kind of thing. And then I had the opportunity in 2013 and 2015 to go to Afghanistan, where in the first year, I was a mentor and coach to the Afghan General Staff. And then in the second year, I was training the 5th and 10th Special Forces and Commandos, KANDAQs, which is an Afghan battalion in ANASOC, ANA, which is ANASOC is the Afghan National Army Special Operations Command, up near the Uzbeki border, out of the Dutch-German base in Mazar-e-Sharif. After that, I won the lottery because I had an opportunity to work for my prime here in CONUS and stop my deployments, which to a certain extent satisfied me and made my family very happy. I have 5 children, 7 grandchildren, and I have my Chasing Ghost podcast, which apparently, Mark, is where you and I connected. And that podcast, it's an irregular warfare podcast, and I feel as if there is a niche for me to scratch at that hasn't been addressed, especially by the irregular warfare and special operations collective in the defense community among defense intellectuals at the Pentagon, DOD, ASD, and all of that, where they don't approach it from a rational perspective, because we're going to discuss this over this interview. But what I've discovered is that the West is incapable of conducting successful counterinsurgency operations, period, across the board. Over.
Yeah. I can't disagree with you on that. You know, you and I've talked offline many times. And so besides being an infantry dude, people on this podcast are probably sick of me reminding them of being an infantry dude because it comes up. But that and a little bit of time in the intel and just, you know, having stepped back, you know, and kind of as more as an observer, yeah, I could see that it's just, that's a whole nother thing we could get into in another podcast. But yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly. We just don't have the mindset. We don't approach the problem. We can't, I feel like we can't even define it. You know what I mean? Like we don't even know what the hell is wrong. But what I want to talk to you now is I want to kind of pull up some of your as an intelligence officer in how problems and assess the potential for, you know, doing a threat assessment, because I came across your episode 37 on your show, Chasing Ghosts, where you talked about the October 7 attack on Israel, and more than just doing a rehashing like so many other, you know, there's plenty of stories on people want to know about it. But, you know, the question that you posed to your audience was, could something like that happen here? So at the time, we're just really this month marks the 1 year of that deadly attack. And so very quickly for the audience, I'm going to go through the time real quick. And then I want to ask you the question, could that happen in America? And information or assessments have you looked at that would lead you to believe that attack would be imminent, but in the planning at least, or in the potential to happen. So is it okay if I go through the timeline real quick?
Please do.
So I pulled these off the official channels, you know, off the State Department website, and I'm not going to put the tinfoil hat on about like, oh, did they allow, you know, none of that. I'm just looking at what are the numbers that we can work through. And that is on October 27th, you know, everyone knows that Hamas, other Palestinian militants groups launched a large scale attack. It was a coordinated attack on the Gaza Strip. So this marked the, well, invasion of Israeli territory since 1948, depending on how you look at it. We did have the Six-Day War, the Yom Kippur War, things like that. As far as an incursion in the 1948 boundaries, all right, not as important as the timeline that we want to go through. So the timing of the assault began during a Jewish holiday, which is part of, I think, Sukkot, but this particular holiday is Simchat Torah. If you're Jewish, you probably know about it. That's about the limit I know about it. But it's a very festive occasion. A lot of the Jewish festivals, you know, involve big family gatherings, friends and getting together or celebrating, things like that. So on that day, there were over 4,300 rockets that were fired into Israel. Militants also used vehicles, powered paragliders to infiltrate Israeli territory. There was a ground incursion, so around 6,000 Gazans, including 3,800 Hamas, quote-unquote, elite forces, and other militants breached the Gaza-Israeli border, attacking military bases and civilian communities. Targeted areas. The militants attacked 21 Israeli communities, right? Many civilians were killed. As far as the casualty goes, the death toll exceeded 1,100, which included 695 Israeli citizens, 71 foreign nationals, 373 members of Israeli security forces. Many were killed in massacres, including 364 at the Nova Music Festival. Concerning the hostages, around 250 civilians and soldiers were taken hostage to Gaza, with Hamas aiming to exchange them for Palestinian prisoners. So the hostages included 12 Americans, four of which were, right, and four were released through an agreement the United States negotiated last November. As the date of this report that I accessed, four still remain in captivity. There were another 97 other hostages who remain held in Gaza today. Men, women, young boys, young girls, babies, elderly people from 25 different nations. So international response, I love this. You know, 44 countries condemned the attack. It just reminds me how people in countries kind of act the same. Every time something bad happens, you know, people feel obligated to throw something on social media, on their profile picture or something, and then do absolutely nothing about it afterwards. Countries are like that too. You know, they feel obligated to posture and say things and then do nothing. Here's what's interesting. So this, the things we're going to talk about here, gang, will pair really well with the episode I did on the terrorist threat cycle a couple of episodes ago. When you listen to this, go back and listen to that episode. We're not going to probably talk about that directly, but when you start planning, marking targets, gathering intelligence, equipping, when dry runs, the execution of it, all that stuff, and then you go back this attack, and then you start forecasting and thinking about how would something like that play out here, understanding the terrorist threat cycle can help you. All right, this is what's interesting, though. Intelligence reports indicate that Hamas spent 2 years planning, like equipping, training, and coordinating before they conduct this attack. So it's a pretty sophisticated attack, really. All right, so now that we have body online, if who's aware of what down, a devastating attack, very brutal, and now there's been a war for about, you know, for a year now, and doesn't look like it's going to be resolved anytime soon. A lot of death, a lot of carnage. It brings the question of, can something like that happen here in the United States? And if so, what leads you to that assessment?
So that's a really good preamble. Mark, I appreciate that. One slight corrective. I think it's October 7th, not October 27th. Yeah. But
oh yeah, it's, but you're right. October 7th. Sorry.
You're gonna find if I'm a guest again, I give my audience a lot of homework as far as reading and podcasts to listen to, because I think that the more informed one is of the backdrop and background that occurred historically, the more you can not only make clear decisions to reach that single most accurate picture now, but you can use that in your toolbox to make forecast assessments that are more rational. And this is something the government tends not to do. So you'll note that Tucker Carlson had a guest on by the name of Daryl Cooper. Daryl and I correspond on occasion, and he's done some terrific historical podcasting, despite what the both the conservatives and the liberals are saying about him, which for the most part is untrue. As a matter of fact, I did a corrective episode in my assessment of Churchill, because in one of Daryl Cooper's moments with Tucker, he said that Churchill was the chief villain of World War II, which I like to refer to as the war to save Joseph Stalin. But in this case, I disagree with him only in specificity. Churchill was not the chief villain. He was one of the chief villains during that entire time. And that's why I did that corrective episode on Winston Churchill on my podcast. Now, the reason I bring that up is Daryl Cooper did this fantastic series. I think it's about 26 hours long, called Fear and Loathing in the New Jerusalem, where he talks about the 19th century run-up all the way to 1948 and the Nakba that occurred in Palestine proper, and stops right there cold with the history. But it gives you a lot of background on what happened and why it happened. Because here's the bottom line. There's no good players in the Middle East. There's no good actors. There's no moral actors. But there are actors who have lived on their turf, lived with their clans, their bloodlines, and their rather jagged lines on a map, not the Churchillian geometry that gave us the Middle East that we have today in the after the World War I and the 1920s. Just a disaster all around. But then again, it is my contention. I'm a reluctant Anglophile. I do think that Churchill is a terrific rhetorician, but for the most part, he's a warmongering clown who managed to get us into far worse circumstances than we would have been without him. Now, I bring up all that because it's so important for the lead up to October 7th, 2023, because the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, are a paper tiger since 1973. If you read the Winograd Commission report from their incursion into Lebanon in 2006, and it was published in 2007, and if you don't want to read the entire report, there's plenty of key findings that are out there that will describe it. Absolute disaster. And in nearly two decades, nothing has changed as far as IDF readiness, because you got to ask yourself this. So here we have Israel, which has been under constant pressure and attack, justifiably on the part of the Arabs, as far as they're concerned, because their perceptions are reality. That if you have, you've got Shin Bet, the military intelligence organizations, you've got Mossad, which is a CIA analog. You probably got a lot of other intelligence organizations there. You know that they get a lot of subsidized intelligence from the United States, of course, since they are almost the 51st state of the United States. Mm-hmm. And excepting Thomas Massie, they have their hands in the puppeteering strings of most of the Congress, whether it's the Senate or the House of Representatives, through AIPAC. Because what AIPAC does is they say, and John Mearsheimer has all the hand receipts and footnotes on this, for I think $60 to $100 million, they purchase the benefit of having the world's present hyperpower on their side at all times in all conflicts, providing war material and all of that stuff. The reason I bring all that up is because you would think that with all those intelligence resources and the fact that the Jewish diaspora sends monies and things like that, you have 70, 80, 90 year old grandmothers in lawn chairs with radios that have been provided to them by the Israeli government on the border who call this stuff in. So when Hamas launches this attack, which is groundborne, airborne, all the rest of it, what you discover is, well, what happened to those grandmothers' reports? What happened to the constant ISR, the intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance that maybe I would suggest is probably pretty substantial, robust on the Israeli border with all of its enemies, and they didn't have indicators or warnings before then. This is all a surprise, and they managed to be surprised by this onslaught. By the way, two things of note here, and I know we're going to be all over the map, Mark, and I apologize. I have a trivia question for you. What percentage of Israelis can possess a firearm when they're not doing their national service?
Oh, it's very small.
2%.
Yeah.
2%. And
so
go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I'll just say, I don't want to pretend like I'm a total expert and know everything about Israel, but I have just from a hobby, I've always been interested in the Middle East and the conflicts there. And I have been to Israel. I've trained with some IDF, keeping contact with some of them. So I spent time in the West Bank and, you know, toured from everything from the Mediterranean to, you know, the Jordanian border, seeing the wall, you know, just all that kind of stuff. So I have maybe more insight than someone who's, you know, only watched a couple of times. But that, I think that assessment is pretty accurate. I think their intel, they're very good with their internal service, being able to find people like, well, and then that coup, they procedures against Hezbollah. I mean, that's insane. They have a lot of victories like that, but you know, when it comes to dealing with things, they're, you know, they don't have, you know, their military, at least their, the army, right, is, they don't have a professional NCO corps. It's a conscript army. You know, most of the duty, unlike in the American military, where the active duty is where, you know, that's the tip of the spear, and then you have reservists and National Guard guys augment it. Theirs is exact opposite. Their conscripts are doing their 2-year or whatever, you know, conscription draft type deal. And then most of their brain trust is really kept within the reserves. And I don't know. I haven't seen, you know, when you see them go on the offense, like into really any of their incursions into Lebanon and everything, they usually get their ass handed to them. Sorry. I mean, or they don't perform like you think they should.
They do not.
You know, versus they're handling things, you know, when they're doing small incursions into Gaza, you know, where it's very contained, very isolated. I mean, pre this conflict, you know, they, as soon as a rocket attack would happen, boom, I see in the news reports, oh, they just rounded up 20 Hamas leaders. It's like they got these guys on speed dial. They know, it's almost like they know where they are every moment of the day, and it can get them if they want. Their human source and info, the PLO, the Hamas, and stuff like that, very good. But yeah, when it comes to the kinetic side, I mean, I'm sorry, man. I was walking around in the West Bank, and I saw dudes, their conscription force, are walking around with barrel flags in, chamber flags in. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
You know, but to get to your point, as far as the civilians, you know, if you go to Tel Aviv to see any civilian walking around with a storm, you go into the settlements areas, that's a different thing. 2%, you know, that you're talking about, most of them are going to be in what is, you know, the mainstream media calls the occupied territories. That's where I saw a lot of people walking around with Glocks and stuff, you know, going to the market and stuff like that. But it's a very small, and I mean, it's highly restricted.
Yeah, if they had had unfettered access to small arms as far as being Israeli citizens, half, if not more, of those casualties, whether wounded or killed, wouldn't have occurred. They would have taken care of it right then and there. But that's just the nature of, you know, Likud is left of left, and the Labor Party is left of left of left. They have always been a government supremacist state. As a matter of fact, here's another little, this really puts the cherry on top. Mark, what percentage of Israeli land is owned by the Israeli government?
Probably most of it, I would imagine.
94%.
Yeah, 94%, right? Because
94%.
They don't want foreign actors buying up their land, unlike
right.
Just let anybody buy anything. But yeah, So continue.
So there's a reason why the Soviet Union was the first nation state to recognize the state of Israel, because they have so much in common politically and always have. Mm. But moving forward, all that background is necessary to understand where they are now. And they were totally unprepared. They were caught flat-footed. And the fratricide that occurred, and I think that there are going to be years and historians in the future who are going to be astonished at the degree of fratricide. For instance, and I can't substantiate this, but apparently there was a concert. And that concert apparently came under fire by IDF forces, and Israelis were killed by IDF forces. But nonetheless, your primary question is, and I'm sorry it took me so long to get to it, Mark, is can that be upscaled and happen here in the United States? For me, it's a matter of when, not if. And I think that with the cavalcade of calamities, this chaos avalanche of illegal immigration and the kind of blinders that the FBI has when it comes to prosecuting terrorism because they're so busy fomenting it and creating it themselves in a variety of circumstances, everything from what happened at Waco to provocateur circumstances in the state of Michigan. That court case is very interesting to show what a clown posse the FBI was in trying to foment that. And for your audience, whenever you go to any kind of meeting that appears to be insurrectionist or don't tread on me or resistance or you name the flavor of right and left wing flavor, even though I think the right wing flavors are far more infiltrated. One out of the three of the folks who are at that meeting, they are either paid informants or they work for the federal government directly. So just make that assumption and it will make your life so much easier. J6 is another instantiation of that on steroids. But I think that as a result of the illegal immigration and the number of MAMs, military age males, that we've had coming in the last 4 years, but it hasn't simply been the last 4 years. It's been the last 20 years. Remember when Powell was shot down in 1962, the trade was made with a Colonel Abel, who was what's referred to in the intelligence trade as a NOC, which is non-official cover. He's not here covertly or clandestinely. The distinction between clandestine and covert is that clandestine is black to black. Covert is where Mark is the agricultural attaché at the embassy in Moscow when he actually works for a three-letter embassy. So that would be covert. Right. But the third category of this are NOCs, non-official covers. And these are the people who come over and they are here participating in sleeper cells, coordinating FISINT activities for whatever their home agency is. But in this case, in 62, when Powell was repatriated in a trade with Colonel Abel, and I think Bridge of Spies with Tom Hanks was a movie that covered that. If you don't want to read the books about it, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Was it Gary Powers or a guy named Powell? I'm confused on that, that they exchanged
Powers.
Abel
Powers. Did I say Powell? Powers, I stand corrected. I think you're right.
Yeah.
Gary Powers.
It was the U2 pilot that got shot down.
Exactly. Yeah, so was piloted
in a spy plane.
Abel was a knock. But then again, the amount of Soviet and communist penetration in the United States in World War II was just off the charts. So we fast forward now today where it isn't so much the Foreign Intelligence Service commitments of the Chinese, the Russians and such, even though I think that all of them are here. I think that there are coordinated Islamist cells in the United States in much greater numbers than any of those. And because of that, in order so that we don't do math on air, what it is that let's say 10,000 Islamist insurgents, MAMs, military age males, are prepared in 10 person cells, coast to coast, maybe Hawaii, maybe Alaska, although they're going to have a very hard time in Alaska if they start because of the propensity for firearms ownership to be so individuated there. But nonetheless, in CONUS, let's suppose, it's Tuesday morning. It's 8:30 East Coast time, maybe 11:30 lunch hour, elsewhere, whatever the case may be. However they want to synchronize that, they all pop off at the same time. And I mentioned in episode 37, two books that I recommend everybody read. William Fortune wrote 1 Second After, which I recommend everybody. But in this case, it's Deus Irae, which is Day of Wrath. And he talks about what this would look like. Well, of course, our friend Kurt Schlichter, in the conservative sphere, has written a number of books, to include his latest book that I talk about in the footnotes. Now, they both come to different conclusions on what the United States would look like once the smoke clears. And I'm not going to be a spoiler for anybody, and I urge you to read both of those books. Both books will corrode your soul. Both of them will make you think, my God, this is just going to be bloody awful. But so if they're 10-man cells, and there's 10,000 of them. What Schlichter portends is he says there's going to be 3 days of wrath. And those 3 days are going to be, they're going to hit public venues on the first day. Mm-hmm. The natural response of the federal government and all the cascading governments down the line to the local level is going to be police forces on the second day after they've mopped up on the first, is that on the second day, they'll go to public venues. Well, Schlichter says then that next 24-hour cycle will be hitting schools and residential mm-hmm. areas. Then the police roll to that. He says the next 24-hour cycle, and this is a prognostication by him, and I think it makes perfect sense from a planning perspective, mm-hmm. is going to be infrastructure mm-hmm. hits. And yeah. and what he's prognosticating is that in those 24-hour cycles, you'll have these 10,000 fire-and-forget Islamist cells that are going to go out there, and they don't need to be directed. All you need to do is pull the trigger and send them. Mm-hmm. They've got all their arms, their armament, their very simple TTP, and they're either going to mm-hmm. be captured, most unlikely, or they're going to martyr themselves, or yeah. they're simply going to fire until they're out of ammunition or out of munitions and out of necks to snap and people to kill and things to do in a very gross mayhem-like manner. So mm-hmm. Schlichter talks about that, and in Deuce Ire by Fortune, he talks about attacks on schools, and he says the attacks on schools would be characteristic because then what they would do is they would have teams waiting on the highway arterials and road arterials going to the schools, knowing that once these attacks occurred, that parents and others and first responders and such would be on the road to get there. And then what happens, mm-hmm. Mark, if you stop one car, two cars, or have a major accident on a highway and everybody's mm-hmm. Isolated and they're stopped and you can't go anywhere? I mean, the feeding frenzy for Islamist cells to go there with their munitions and their guns and their RPGs and their grenades, mm-hmm. it would be a horrible thing. I would say that if this were to clack off tomorrow morning and then the smoke started clearing 72 hours later, you're looking at 100,000 dead and hundreds of thousands of maimed and killed. And Schlichter brings up something that's really disturbing and interesting. And you had mentioned, Mark, that you live near a college town. Mm-hmm. He said that there will probably be unpaid informants and auxiliaries among the university students. And eerily, we see this with the Palestine movement across the board, mm-hmm. where they're going to clog up 911 lines. They're going to participate. Mm-hmm. in the mayhem. They're going to assist in any way, fashion to stop first responders or whatever the case may be. So I like to use this phrase chaos avalanche, and I think it means so much in so many things here in the United States, but this mm-hmm. will create a chaos avalanche that will roll into circumstances that will make responding to it very difficult. So here's what's going to happen though. The smoke's going to clear. And there's a fork in the road. The fork in the road is, do we have unfettered access to firearms granted to all Americans to stop this from ever happening again? Or, and this is what Fortune talks about in his book, is it used by the central government in the United States and the West to stop free speech, stop the carrying of arms, and do all the usual things that a central government would do to ameliorate that hazard from happening again, which is usually very Orwellian. So that would be a fork in the road. So there it is.
Wow. That's a investment. And you know, it's so funny. I don't mean that in a,
I get it.
I mean it. Yeah. It's ironic, I guess is the word I'm looking for is, you know, just like anything like this, there's been, and things like that, that when the brain, we're so used to it, right, scenario starts talking about this in real life, the brain just almost shuts off. Like, you know what I mean? It's almost like the concept has been normalized, but then it's been downgraded to fiction. Oh, that's not really going to happen. Oh, you're just fear-mongering. And it's interesting that you bring this up, and I had you on the show like right now, because ironically I just did a transmission on sleeper cells, and I mentioned Abel versus the powers exchange and stuff like that. And the reason why is a few weeks ago there was a guy, I don't know him, somewhere kind of actually in my area, but it's like supposedly a retired special forces guy, but he sent a video talking about, you know, on the anniversary of October 1st that something could kick off soon. And I bet I got three or four people send me that email with minutes of each, not email, that video within minutes of each other saying, hey, could this really happen? And I'll tell you, I mean, and that's why I did that transmission. And I said, you know, at the caveat, I said, no tinfoil hat, no conspiracy theory, because you don't have to. And I pulled out actual documented stuff that our law enforcement apparatus has investigated, made arrests. There have been convictions. And I just list those. I was like, you don't have to put a tinfoil hat on. This stuff is real. These groups are here. And, you know, I would say, first of all, let's look at this from, well, what is the purpose of a sleeper cell, right? They are to infiltrate and embed. They are to prepare, you know, number one, doing surveillance, intelligence, training and equipping, and basically until they get the green light. So you could say, why hasn't something like that kicked off? Well, it depends who is behind the sleeper cell. If it's a state-sponsored cell, obviously, like, let's just take Iran or some country. Well, you know, it's not to their benefit of that kickoff right now. It's to their benefit if we were to become involved in a conflict with them. So you could see a scenario where if we got into a war with Iran, you could see them activating their Hezbollah cells, you know, or that are here, that we know are here, that have been documented, that we've had arrests and stuff like that, you know, so forth and so on. And so, yeah, it's really interesting. It can be, it is scary, it's grim, but, you know, we've had these groups coming over at least since the 60s. And it's funny that I came across this stuff back when I used to teach them to law enforcement, where I began to show them like some of the networks. I said, you know, some of these networks came here, began organizing on college campuses back in the 1960s, and have been working every day since then to recruit, to gain intelligence. You know, you talk about the law enforcement, we've already had, you know, reports and things like that. You know, thinking about during the lone wolf craze then in the 2010s and the Islamic State that was happening, that there were reports of guys here knocking on doors of law enforcement officers, approaching them in public, you know, making veiled threats. And you imagine these guys are finding out names, addresses of where the law enforcement, you know, where does the security apparatus live, you know, and things like that. Those are taking surveillance of infrastructure and grid and stuff like that. All just like this Israeli attack was 2 years in the making, obviously more because Hamas has been operating since the 80s. It's not like they've been sitting on their duff that whole time. But this particular attack, I mean, it's not like the long-term planning. So there are these groups, whether they be from China, Russia, state-sponsored groups like Hamas and Hezbollah, other groups. And we're not even talking about the organic group are here too, you know, that are born and raised, that are part of the citizenry. Yeah, that network. And I was like, well, yeah, that's possible. We know there, we have documented evidence of these groups being operational here in this group. So yeah, I mean, and not for me to, you know, monopolize the soapbox, you know, you just think about to really cripple a country. I remember the days of the Beltway snipers. That two dudes, you know, before we found out who they were shooting from and all that, and they Beltway. And not only that, I remember the gas pump, because a lot of people were shot, you know, in parking lots or getting gas and stuff like that. I remember looking over my shoulder just saying, man, it's, you know, could that happen here and everything? And they really, because the whole nation was fixated on what was going on in the Beltway, that it psychologically number on all of us, you know, in a sense. I mean, it was at least crossing your mind. You could see that, and that's just two dudes. You could imagine people in several states, several towns, you know, and you look at the Mumbai attack, you look at the Paris attack, you know, and I was telling law enforcement officers, I was like, hey, right now with this lone wolf stuff, everyone's focused on one event, one shooter, maybe two. I was thinking in terms of how you would respond if you had multiple attacks in your city. You know, where are your soft points? Where are your grid points, your infrastructures, your schools, your wherever? And imagine, you know, primary, secondary, tertiary attacks kicking off in succession. You know, how are you going to handle that? You know, and
at well, the they're time, not.
Nobody really had.
They don't have the capability. They simply don't have the capability to do it.
They don't.
And, yeah. And you and I, you're much more conversant in law enforcement. And you and I talked about this offline. Is they're some of the worst marksmen in America. Is cops. Even their SWAT teams leave something to be desired because. Their SWAT teams, except for their sniper overwatches, which for urban snipers is approximately 150 meters in the aggregate for their average shot. Mm-hmm. They're great at CQB. The government owns CQB. They don't own long shots. They don't own surprise. And they don't own what's going to happen if they roll into a house where they take the door down and they all roll in there from the stack. And all of a sudden they find themselves in a fence link cage. And then something occurs as a result of that. They're not prepared for that sort of thing. And they're certainly not prepared for this kind of thing with the scalability that I think that we're going to see. Because how will they handle, for instance, what is going to happen to the 911 system if, again, for math purposes, 10,000 of these folks clack off at 8:30 on Tuesday morning in California or the East Coast? What are those emergency response systems going to look like? You talked about those DC snipers. Remember what happened with Dorner in California? He paralyzed. They're one man paralyzed their law enforcement system. It's going to be very ugly, and we're simply not prepared for it. But there is one way to ameliorate the threat immediately, and that's this. And it won't happen in America. Without unfettered access to small arms of every type for everyone, criminals get them because they break laws for a living. Without that, you cannot reduce the body count relying on first responder and police forces to come to your aid. And as you and I discussed offline, the police don't even have an obligation to protect you as an individual due to three Supreme Court cases.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. You know, I've said this with other guests and stuff. I don't think anybody would argue this, but in a modern society, you know, particularly here in the West, become addicted and really obsessed with safety and comfort, you know? And so I see where something like that kicks off, just have people in droves saying, hey, just outsourcing it to the government and saying, hey, whatever it takes, whatever rights we need to take, whatever, just fix it. You know what I mean? Like, it's not even going to have to be. Yeah, it's not going to be a hard sell. And of course, you know, once those rights, they'll give them back, right? Once the once the event is passed, right? We know
that. Indeed. Yeah.
You know, every time you pass hooks, right? Once there's not a need for that law, they go back and repeal it, right?
Right.
So yeah, that's what's scary to me, seeing that the majority of citizenry will, you know, instead of saying, how can we be more resilient? How can we protect ourselves? You know, roll over to the government and say, hey, you do it, whatever it takes. I think that's a real issue too. But
there is something I want to address, which is going to happen to 8 to 12 hours into the first event on the first day, if it goes in a 3-day sequence, as both Fortune and Schlichter forecast, they're going to call in the military, National Guard, reserves, maybe active forces. They are not going to help. And here's what's going to happen. Here's my forecast. The military is going to bring in some heavy weapons. They're going to bring in possibly armor, possibly IFVs and things like that. And they're going to bring those in cities. And Hamas, Hezbollah, the Islamist, they are terrible conventional fighters and always have been. Read Kenneth Pollack's book, Armies of Sand, on why Arabic and Middle Eastern forces are so bad when it comes to conventional warfare. But when it comes to irregular warfare and insurgency and things like that, they're superb. So once these once this heavy metal starts rolling through the cities, because there's going to be a lot of concentration in the cities mm-hmm. for these attacks, then the mayhem will step up even more, because you're going to see tanks, IFVs, Humvees, and everything decimated. And it doesn't take, you know, maybe they don't have AT-4s. Maybe they don't have RPGs. But I'll bet there's a liquor store there, and I'll bet there's a place that they can get towels and paper towels and all the things that you need as accelerants. Because an Abrams is an awesome beast. It's an expensive beast. And by the way, I think that the era of man-tank warfare is over. But nonetheless, that's for another podcast that you and I discussed, another episode we discuss. It is that if I put that Molotov cocktail or two or three on the air infill deck on the back of that Abrams, it's going to light up and it's going to go up, and you're going to brew up a $5 to $8 million piece of machinery for the price of a bottle of vodka. I mean, and this is going to happen. There are so many, Mark, there are so many cavalcades of calamities that are going to result from these 3 days of madness and mayhem. And like I said, I hate to be alarmist. And by the way, I want to be wrong. I want to say that it's an if and not a when. But I can't fulfill my historical fiduciary duty by saying something like that, because I think it's foolhardy right now. Because what the U.S. has been doing since the beginning of the 20th century in league with the British and other European powers is putting their finger on the chest of many Middle Eastern indigs that just want to be left alone. That just want to live their lives and do what they want, but they suffer invasion. For instance, in Afghanistan, two things you'll note. Number one, Afghanistan doesn't exist outside of Kabul as a country. I wish we had sort of grokked that in 2001, but we didn't. And number two, that when you press them and press them and press them, especially if you invade them, you're going to have a minimum of 10% of any respective population in any Middle Eastern country that will never accept Christians and Jews, because that's how they'll characterize any Western forces that make landfall on their soil. They will never accept that invasion, and they will fight it until they are dead. And the response, and one of the reasons why I think the U.S. and the West has failed so spectacularly when it comes to counterinsurgency, is that you can only stack up and maim and kill so many women and children and not think that you are stiffening the spine of the resistance and that you're going to increase the mass forces they will be able to enlist to fight the invader on the ground. That grunt math doesn't work in the U.S. favor, and everybody in D.C. seems to be blind to it.
Yeah. That's interesting. Well, let's talk about some things that are maybe, you know, obviously, we have just covered a pretty grim scenario of things that are outside the control of you and the common everyday person. So let's talk about things that we can control.
Okay.
What are things that we, you know, as individuals can do to try to get ready for something like that? Hoping that it never does, but still preparedness, right? How should we prepare for that?
So I covered this. Did you listen to all the episodes in Storming America?
I'm still going through them. I've listened to last two. A few of them. I haven't made it to the last two yet.
No, because I had other folks get in touch with me and say, okay, what can we do about it? You know, the question that you're posing to me right now. And in reference to my unfettered access to firearms, I wish we could get rid of the NFA. As a matter of fact, I wish the federal government would simply get out of weapons regulation, but that'll never happen. That would solve a whole bunch of our problems. The number one thing that people can do is learn to be aware of your surroundings. And as old Remus used to tell us, stay away from crowds, do your area intelligence studies. And area intelligence studies, by the way, that you don't have to be an intelligence officer or professional to do these. For instance, political signs and yards in my neighborhood, I always make a list so that I know who lives nearby and who is a possible threat to me and who isn't. You learn alternative arterials that are in your neighborhood. Your head is on a swivel. Mark, I am sure from talking to you, you're the same way as me. When you walk into a restaurant, you and I are not Jason Bourne. That's not what I'm saying. But you and I walk into a restaurant and we will have a wall at our backs and we'll be in a position in the restaurant or whatever venue we're at where we have our eye on the exits. We have our eyes on the, on in the Navy, we would call it the hatches, but the doors. We are constantly aware in a Jeff Cooper fashion with his color code of what's going on. And we're not in condition white, which is where we're completely oblivious to what's going on around us.
Sure.
Weapons. I am a Glock aficionado. I've carried one since 1991. I'm probably an original gangster when it comes to Glocks. I just really dig them. ARs, the Stoner platform to me, is the one and only to use. So many calibers available. But as far as women are concerned, they can carry Glocks too. AR rifles, the Stoner platform, you can get those in 9mm. I built one for my wife that weighs under 8 pounds. I mean, I specifically went out of my way to make it lightweight for it. It's a left-handed AR, as a matter of fact. So the ejection port is on the other side because she's left-handed. And my children started shooting when they were 4. And when they were 5, they got a rifle. When they were 8, they got a pistol. My grandchildren, same thing. Training takes place. I used to be an Appleseed instructor, if you're familiar with that program. And I was a shoot boss in Arizona. Great marksmanship program. It's not simply about marksmanship. It's also about making sure that you have the right vehicle at the right time with the right amount of fuel in it. Again, head on a swivel, water filtration devices, all those things that one would normally have if the grid goes down, to make sure that you can provide for your family. Because Marcus, husbands and fathers, you and I have 3 jobs. Number one is provision. Number two is protection. Those will reverse, by the way, the more spicy times become. But the third one is this. I'm going to tell you this. It'll take less than a minute. Don't be bored by this, but I think you'll get what I'm getting at when I say this.
Yeah.
So my father, in my youth, I'm 8 years old. I'm wandering about. I was born and raised in Miami. So we're in Miami. And I'm looking around. I'm very inquisitive. I say, hey, Dad, who built those cars? Who built those buildings? Who built all that stuff? He says, men did. And then I looked at him and I said quizzically, and I'm paraphrasing here, how could I remember that possibly word for word? And I looked at him quizzically. And I said, well, Dad, what did women build? And he said, us. And the reason I say that, Mark, is because the reason women build us is why you and I are expendable. So if you get in the mindset where you say that as men, civilization will stop cold if we don't protect women, for provisioning and protecting as husbands and fathers to do that. So if you take that whole bundle there and put it together, you figure out what your obligations are when it comes to this.
Very good. Very good. Yeah, we're almost out of time. Really good conversation. Definitely we'll have you back on if you're open to that, because there's more stuff we could talk about. So
we could talk about irregular warfare and insurgency and counterinsurgency and guerrilla warfare for many hours.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm a big fan of it's a small read, but man, it was written during still, you probably already know the name of the book I'm going to mention, but I think it's the primer on understanding these, but The War of the Flea, I'm sure you've read that book. I highly recommend it. That will really kind of give you a window into these guys operate, you know, and how, what's them so effective and why they're so hard to defeat, and why, you know, the tanks and missiles and the Humvees, you know, just can't get it done. You know, it takes different approach, and that's something in the West our brain are just, you know, wired for bigger, large scale, conventional kind of stuff, and you know, a different beast, right?
But so Mark, I have to say this though, you just said our brains are wired for big conventional unified land operations and things like that. The West can't do insurgency well, it can't do special operations well, it can't assassination campaigns. It's fairly proficient at that. When it comes to conventional warfare, I am here to tell you that America is in the terminal phase of its ability to project power abroad. Terminal phase. Whether you look at the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, the Army, whatever the case may be, we have all these exquisite platforms and we have a great NCO Corps and we have all of this, but our flag officers, along with the SESs and all the rest of them, for the past five decades, arguably back to 1945, there's a reason why the U.S. hasn't won a conflict since 1945. Mm. We're in the cancer ward as far as our ability to fight a conventional war. Now, in the first 48 hours, I suspect United States forces will be shock and awe, and the world will say, wow, that's amazing. After that 48 hours, everything will go downhill.
Yeah. I mean, you definitely see that with the Iraqi campaign, right? The first drive into Baghdad, man, just like tech. And then, you know, it all just apart after that. So, yeah, I agree with you, man. Let's talk about, what are kind of new projects, or is anything new that you're working on, or something that you want to make sure people are looking out for?
Man, you are so kind to ask that, Mark. Thank you so much. So I urge everybody to listen to my podcast if you get a chance. If you get a chance to leave reviews for it on the vendor that you use, I would appreciate that. I am the Smedley D. Butler Fellow for Military Affairs at the Libertarian Institute, and they have a blog over there. And about 3 to 5 times a week, I write about what's going on with the military in the U.S. and the West, and why things are so awful, especially from a materiel standpoint. I write everything from, you know, Navy failures, both surface and subsurface, to the Army's headlong rush into green fighting and wanting to adopt an electric or hybrid version of the tank. And you know, when you look at that, Mark, you've got to ask yourself, what fool would want to be on top of a 2-ton lithium battery on a battlefield, taking rounds in a fiery environment in which you may very well find yourself being rained upon or by both artillery and water, or making river crossings and things like that? How does that work? It takes, for an M1A1 Abrams to fill its 500-gallon tank, we've got ways where we can do that in about 10 to 15 minutes, I suspect. As an 11, as a light infantryman, I was passed by armor vehicles on ruck marches, but I never fought out of IFVs or fought with tanks. So I know it as a spectator, but I think to myself, how does that thinking, Mark, get past the room where maybe you've got guys who formerly served in Iraq or Afghanistan, and not one of them raises their hand and says, you know, this idea of hybrid and electric batteries in infantry fighting vehicles and tanks, do you realize what hazardous conditions you would expose your soldiers to if they took a round? It's bad enough to take a round in that fuel blivet that of 500 gallons that's in a tank, but what's going to happen when that hits a lithium battery? Good God. But yeah. Anyhow, on the blog, I cover this stuff, and when you read this in its totality, you just sit back and you go, how can we fight our way out of a paper sack? I mean, it's so awful. It's just so awful.
Yeah.
So well, I'm doing that stuff at the blog. And of course I get invited by great folks like you to bloviate about these things.
I'm going to put your link to your writings and to your podcast in the show notes, but what's the name of your podcast, just for those who just want to look at it
Ghost up right now? And a Regular Warfare podcast, just published episode 55. I can't believe it. Episode 55. I try to publish them like clockwork every fortnight. And 56 is coming up, and I'm thinking, and Mark, I'm not committing to this, but everybody says, Bill, you've spent almost, you know, over 50 episodes just slamming the military establishment. How do we fix it? And I've addressed that scattershot, but I may just start looking as a project series at how do we fix the joint level and how do we fix the other services. But a decision has to be taken, and that's this. The reason why the Russians and the Chinese are so good at what they do from a conventional military perspective is they're regional hegemons. They're not global policemen. They're not running around planet-wide trying to put their fingers in the dike in everything that they see. They're not subject, for the most part, to the IED. I call it DEI IED because I like that to be explanatory of what its total objective is. But we'd have to take a decision for my design of the force structure for America. we have to take the decision first and foremost as a rational concept of operations. Are we a regional hegemon or a global hegemon? Are we a regional hegemon with occasional 911 global response forces to secure American citizens? I don't know, but you can't design a force structure without taking that decision. And there is no, both political parties in the United States are committed to this global hegemonic enterprise that has caused us so much grief.
Yeah. Well, you know, that, and that's, maybe that's something we can do another episode on, but I'll just kind of maybe do a soft intro if we sure. do get to that. I mean, I think facts on the ground geopolitically are going to catch up eventually with the makers we're not going to have a choice. Globalism is dying. It's ending. I think we're going to just de facto have to revert more to a regional type posture anyway. So the problem is, can we do it in time? But anything. Okay. So that'll wrap us up. Do you have any laughs or anything else that you want to say before we close it down?
I do, Mark, and it should take just a short amount of time. I'm so happy that you brought up, you know, all the grim and dim prognostications you and I have entertained this past hour. Mm-hmm. What can a family do? What can an extended family do? Mm-hmm. Neighbors, things like that, getting together. You and I mentioned what can be done. I would urge everybody to take your own protection as seriously as you can, because the police aren't going to save you. The armed forces aren't going to save you. You are on your own. We just went through a hurricane down here in Florida, and my heart swells because of how neighbors and friends and family get together, and we all put our shoulders to the wheel and move forward. And there's the government way behind us in the rearview mirror. Helene, I happen to be a former resident of, yes, this is the name of the town, Meat Camp, North Carolina, in the mountains near Boone, North Carolina. Very hardy people, very individuated people, very hardy people, because I'm also a former resident of North Idaho. Same thing applies to them. Very hardy people, self-reliant and such. What happened there as far as the federal response is just, it's abominable. But one thing everybody has to keep in mind, again, and this riffs with what we're talking about, FEMA has one job and one job only, and that's continuity of the federal government. Look it up. That's it. That's its prime job. All the rest of this is ancillary stuff that they volunteer for, or if they choose not to, they won't. Yeah. Thanks for having me on, Mark. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, man. So good. There's a lot of other topics I think we can cover, and I hope to do that in the future. So, Bill, thank you so much for making yourself available. I know you're super busy, and really honored that you would come on. So, Matt, folks, I'll put all your links in the show notes. If you have any comments on this episode, go ahead and drop them or email them to me. All that information for you to contact me. Let me know what you think, what you'd like me and Bill to talk about next time. So until then, on behalf of Bill and myself, I'm going to tell you to stay sharp and keep it pearl snap. Thanks, guys.
I just stopped recording.
All right. Cool. Okay. So I see it's buffering now. That's a good, a lot of good stuff, man. A lot of good stuff.
Hey, the video was really fuzzy that I'm seeing of you, and I'm hoping that's not, is my video fuzzy to you?